All right. Welcome, everybody, to the 10th episode of the Board Game OK podcast, a podcast about board games and the hobby of board gaming, recorded in spring, sunny, but a bit cold Helsinki, Finland. I am one of your hosts, Luis, and with me is your other host, Jonas.
Moi.
In this episode, we'll be discussing everything about teaching board games or teaching a board game. So the teach, what is the right approach and what is the wrong approach, do's and don'ts, and how to behave when someone is explaining a game. But before we get to that, we're going to review three games, Sardinia, Splendor Duel, and Faraway. So Jonas, why don't you start us and tell us a little bit more about Sardinia or Sardegna?
Sardinia is a new version of an old Stefan Dorra game called Creta. In Sardinia, 3 to 4 players try to control the island of Sardinia by placing their pieces in the 16 different provinces of the island. When it comes to mechanics, Sardinia feels like a mix of El Grande and Concordia, two games we have discussed before, and two games that are, at least to me, personal favorites. So, what is El Grande about Sardinia? Sardinia is an area maturity game, just like El Grande. And like in El Grande, you will end up moving your pieces around the board to different regions, trying to pick the right battles and setting yourself up for scoring rounds. There is no actual fighting, just like in El Grande, but instead you try to build the strongest presence in the provinces that will give you the most points. What's different in Sardinia is that you have multiple different types of pieces. Mm-hmm. Villagers, priests, and fleets need to be first brought from your supply onto the board. And once on the board, you can start moving them around. You also have buildings, villages, and forts that you cannot move once you have decided where you want to build them. Just like in real life, Luis.
Mm-hmm.
The Concordia DNA comes in with the action selection. Like in Concordia, everyone starts with the same personal hand of cards, and on your turn, you play a card and do what it says. Very simple. And yes, there is a card that lets you pick up all the cards into your hand so you can continue playing them. This pick up all your cards card also initiates scoring. So if any of the players plays their scoring card, the game stops and we score the current provinces. But what are the current provinces? All of the intersections or the corners of the province borders are numbered. And for every one of these intersections, there's a scoring card for that same number. But we will score only 11 of the 26 intersections in the game. No more, no less. And when an intersection is scored, we score every province that is, you know, connecting to that intersection.
Mm-hmm.
And we will only know which are the next 2 intersections out of 26 that will score. The rest remain unknown until they are revealed. If you are the one who initiates scoring, you get to flip the next card from the deck. And to me, this is one of the funniest moments in the game. If you don't like the card you flipped face up, you can just trash it and top deck a new scoring card.
Mm-hmm.
So if I initiate scoring and then get to reveal a new card, that card might be really good for you, Luis, and not good for me at all. So I will trash that card and say, nope, we are not doing that. And you will go, no, Jonas.
No, Jonas.
Sometimes the card is really good for me and therefore I keep it. I don't trash it. And then sometimes the card is somewhere in between. Not bad, but not great either. And then I'm just pushing my luck if I decide to flip a new card. And yeah, it's very funny when I flip a new card that's great for everyone else and just straight up garbage for me.
Mm.
So there's a lot to like in Sardinia. The beginning of the game is interesting as you try to decide how much are you going to push for early points. The middle game is also very fun as it becomes more and more important to have the power to get to draw the next scoring card, and players have started to kind of claim parts of the island to themselves with their buildings. But the end game, it has been a miss in all of the 3 games I've played, and I cannot see it playing any differently in future games.
Yeah.
Here's the problem. Once we reveal the last 2 scoring cards, there's no more unknowns regarding which provinces will score. So if the last 2 cards say 11 and 25, then 11 and 25 will be the last intersections to score, and there's nothing you can do about it. And by this point, most of the players will have placed all of their buildings and units on the map as well. And now it's just two full rounds of everyone playing the cards from their hand as if we are robots trying to move our pieces to the final scoring provinces, which, by the way, can only hold 7 pieces. So it's just turn after turn, people rushing their pieces. Everyone knows which card everyone will play. There's 0 surprises left. Everything is solvable, but we have to keep playing for 2 rounds.
Yeah.
And this has really left a bad taste in my mouth after every single play.
Okay.
In addition to this, even before the last scoring cards are revealed, you are starting to run out of the pieces to put out on the map, which means you have less and less decisions to make in the game. It's just all of the suspense starts to disappear little by little after you hit a certain point in the game. And because of that, I just can't recommend the game, even though everything else in the game is very much my jam. You know, simple rules, lots of interaction, lots of big moments. One of the big selling points of Sardinia is the packaging. So let's talk about the game box. I'm taking out the game from under the table.
Okay. Ooh, that's pretty small.
Louis, how would you describe the shape and size of the game?
Well, it's a portable box that seems to kind of unfold. That looks nice and cute.
And size-wise, it's kind of like, you know, those Amico card games? So like a card game box that holds like a deck divided into 2.
Yeah.
It's like 3 of them maybe stacked.
Yeah.
Together.
Yeah. Or 4 small Oink games like stacked 2 and 2.
Yeah. But like a cute little brick.
Yeah.
Chilla today asked me, what is that, when I was packing it? And I thought she was asking, what game is it?
Yeah.
No, she was asking, what is that object that was on the table?
Yeah.
Okay. Louis, now please narrate as if you were David Attenborough as I opened the box and set up the game board.
Jonas is in his natural environment. He is happy opening his box. The box unfolds as by magic, revealing some magnets and a cute container. And what? The box that seemed to be magnets rolled around the other container are now displaying a beautiful map that is not very big. It's actually quite small, with different sections with victory points. And the box is the map. The map is the box. Jonas doesn't seem surprised at all.
Yeah, the box itself turns into the map, which is kind of like how they can package everything into such a small box. But it's still a big box game. If you play it, it feels like a big box game. It's just in a small box. Yeah, and the footprint itself is also very small, which means that this is a great travel game. You can take it anywhere and you can play it anywhere. When you combine the board, because it's like kind of like 2 pieces that you put together, there's magnets. It doesn't lay out fully flat, but it has not bothered me or probably the other players as well at any of the plays. And you can also teach it to almost anyone. And people seem to really get the idea very fast. So there's like a lot of interaction and you kind of feel like, oh, there could be a lot of gotchas in the game. But I think like people have picked it up, the strategy, very well. And every time we have played, the game has received just a lot of compliments about the box. One more final note. Playti, the publisher of Sardinia, also released Tonga Bonga at the same time as Sardinia. Tonga Bonga is also an old Stefan Dora game and comes in this same small magnetized box. That one I haven't had the chance to try out yet, even though I own it. But I'm looking forward to getting it played and hopefully reviewed in a future episode. But that was Sardinia by Stefan Dora.
What would you change about the end game if you could?
Yeah,
in order to make it better.
Yeah, I have thought about, is it fixable in any way? But since the last 2 scoring cards are, you know, visible, or you can't change them anymore, and if you could change them, well, maybe if you add some kind of mechanic where you could like do like a switcheroo with the last 2 scoring cards, but even that, it just might add like too many extra rules for an otherwise simple game. You know, like, oh, in the last 2 turns, now we enter this mechanic where you can start drawing cards and then replacing cards. I don't know if it would make any sense.
Okay, because otherwise I would be really excited to play it. But like from that, it really feels demotivating to know that like, it's going to be an okay game until the end of the game where it's like...
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, now I'm going to talk about Splendor
Duel. Splendor Duel is the re-implementation of Splendor. It has the same DNA. I think it plays completely different because it is obviously a two-player game, but you can see the similarities. It's a game designed by Marc André and Bruno Catala and released in 2022. Actually, I felt that it was released a lot later, but it seems to be around since 2022. All right, Jonas, imagine that you are an artisan in a royal court competing to create the most impressive collection of jewels and artwork. This is exactly what you're doing in Splendor Duel. But let's break down the mechanics, actually, because the theme, yeah, it's there, but it's mostly like a strategic game of back and forth. So you got this 5x5 board with colored chips representing different jewels, like you have white for diamonds, red for rubies, and so on. And you have a card displayed representing different works of art or different jewelry that you make in your workshop. And you have easy, medium, and hard, or levels 1, 2, and 3. Some cards have victory points, some cards have crowns on them, and some cards have extra bonus actions. All of the cards have also a cost in the number of jewels that you have to pay for them. Obviously, level 1 cards are a little bit cheaper than level 2, and level 3 cards are obviously the most expensive, but the ones that give you the best bonuses and the nicest actions or highest number of crowns. On your turn, you got two main actions, either grab chips or buy cards from the display. And the strategy is all about seeing what chips you can grab and seeing what works of art or what jewelry you can make, and then kind of trying to combine what you have there into how you can get the victory condition. So all of the cards have also jewelry or chips printed of them, which means that once you buy a card, you're building your engine or you're building your workshop reputation, if you want to think about it thematically, in order to be able to build better jewelry later on. So you grab a black card, it will have a black chip, which means that you will have to pay one less black chip later on to buy cards that have a cost in black chips. The way you grab chips from the 5x5 board is that you have to take three adjacent chips or up to three adjacent chips. And then this becomes a really like kind of strategic puzzle of what you want to take in order to block your opponent from taking this. There's also some gold chips that allow you to reserve some cards, which can allow you to block your opponent or even like secure the victory for you. Hey, I want this card. I don't want the other player to get it from me. The goal is simple. It's the first to hit 20 victory points or collect 10 crowns, which are again printed on the card, or collect 10 victory points of a single color. And this is also where the game becomes quite interesting because you might be winning on victory points. You might be having 15, but at the same time, I have maybe 6 victory points only, but in one single color. So who's actually winning? It's really hard to say. It really depends on the cards that come up. It really depends on how you build your engine. And ultimately, it's a bit luck dependent on the cards that come out. But at the same time, it's a very fast game that you can play quite easily. And if you lose, it doesn't feel that punishing. But I think one thing that impressed me, or one thing that made this game shine for me, is that feeling of like you're winning or not being sure if you're winning, if your opponent is also close to another victory condition. So there's a lot of tension between both opponents. Like you never know who's in the lead. Sometimes towards the very end, maybe it's quite obvious and there's some things that maybe you cannot block. But I think with more plays, with more experience, you can kind of devise strategies to like make sure that you're at least in a position to block your opponent if they are getting ahead. So yeah, that is pretty much Splendor Duel. It's a really good game. The box is quite small, so it's pretty portable. I think I like it more than Splendor, at least myself. I'm not going to talk about Splendor, but I like it more. And it's a fantastic two-player game. I would really recommend this for anyone that likes simple yet strategic two-player games. Splendor Duel.
Why are you not going to talk about Splendor, the superior game?
I don't know. I think Splendor lacks on that tension. Like, I think it's a good game. It's a good, simple game. And I think you can play it with anyone. But I don't feel it's as good of a game as this one. I think Splendor is like a generic good game from back in the day that for sure you can play, like Carcassonne or Catan. It's like they are classics for a reason. They're good games, but do you really need them in your collection? Depends.
I love Splendor. To me, Splendor is like candy. Mm-hmm. You know, like when I play it, it's just this immediate satisfaction. Did you say boring or it lacks tension?
It lacks the tension that this one has.
Yeah, I'm on the edge of my seat every time I'm playing Splendor. And, you know, continuing this candy analog, it's like, can I eat a whole bag of candy? Yes. Can I play the whole day to Splendor? Yes. And will I have fun playing Splendor? Yes. The same way I will have fun eating candy. But will I feel satisfied after eating all that candy or playing all that Splendor? Yeah, no. But does that stop me from eating candy in the future? Nope. I'll do it again next week.
What about Splendor Duel?
I guess with Splendor Duel, my big question is that, okay, what do these different mechanics add to the experience? I get the three different victory conditions that you're going for. That changes the rhythm of the game a little bit, since you cannot just, you can't have this like single track mind focusing on that one goal. You have to look at what your opponent is doing. We just finished a game of Splendor Duel with Luis, and I was not looking that he was about to sneak in a victory with collecting a lot of blue gems.
Yeah, and I think that's the gist of it. I think in Splendor, there's really not much way to block your opponent. Like if they're going for a win, if they have the right luck, or if you're playing with other people, like it's semi-luck dependent.
Wow, this is like beginner talk.
Really?
Yeah, you play.
Yeah, I guess I have played it. Like last time I played was like three times, and I have maybe played 5 times in all my life. So yes, this is definitely beginner's talk.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just feels, I've never felt that compelled for Splendor.
I think I might be like 50 plus games in on Splendor. And you know, once you start playing with sharks, there are ways to block people because there are good cards and there are not so great cards. Of course, it's going to be dependent on like who is collecting those cards. Mm. So you do have to do this blocking while collecting your own cards at the same time.
Can you do it in a two-player game as easily?
Well, I don't know. I can't remember how much I have experience from two-player games, but I would assume so. I heard someone saying that, oh, the two-player Splendor is broken strategically. Mm. And I went quickly on BGG today to see, like, is there any, like, what's the reasoning for it? And apparently there's something with the distribution of the colors and whatnot. I'm not that deep into Splendor. I do not want to get that deep into Splendor. So I just stopped reading there because I was like, I don't need to have this information in my head. This will ruin the game for me.
No, I hear you. I'm maybe a beginner with Splendor. I just don't feel that the game is that good. But I might be wrong. I might need to play with more sharks, I guess.
Yeah, but I think Splendor is one of those games that, you know, some people will find it boring. And I can't really make a counter argument to it. Because my counter argument is like, it's not boring. Mm-hmm. Why do you say it's boring?
Yeah,
I am very excited when I play Splendor.
Yeah.
But the first game of Splendor I played, I was hooked immediately. So it's just, I think it's just how is one brain built. It just gave me the right dopamine hit.
Yeah.
And I mean, like base Splendor, it's like instant dopamine. You get this card. Now you build up for a card and soon you're getting cards for free. Yeah. That is addictive.
But I think that, for example, that translates directly here. Like you can do that here as well. You get the chips so you can play with the chips in your hand. So you have the toy factor.
Yeah, but you know, can I tell you what my problem with that is? With these extra mechanics, then they get in the way. Because all I want to do is I just want to collect cards. I just want to have my card and then just collect new cards.
That is true.
And now I have to look at these privilege tokens. I have to look at that. Okay,
but I think they add to the two-player experience. I think this two-player experience is exactly, it feels similar sometimes to Seven Wonders Duel, where like you have that tension where you never know. Mm-hmm. This one feels faster, feels like less of a commitment than Seven Wonders Duel. Seven Wonders Duel feels a little bit slower, even though maybe there I have played a lot, but still like I have that tension of like I want to win, so I need to overthink. Here I don't feel that I have to overthink that much. Like if I don't win, fine, but I think it has like all of the elements of being extra strategic enough, tense enough, but also fast and simple to teach, simple to play. That is just like hits the right spots to take anywhere, play with anyone. But in particular, Mia also enjoys this one quite a lot. So we played it together and I think we'll continue playing it together. She prefers cooperative games, so she doesn't love that many like competitive games when we play together. But this one she's happy to play, I think, also because it's like the commitment is not that big. So
the commitment is not that big. What do you mean? Like you don't have to spend too much time with
You don't have to spend like 2 hours. It's just like 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, it's done.
Yeah, because it is very head-to-head.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like you can do mean moves here. And when your opponent is, you know, ending the game when you're just about to start, you feel like, come on, just give me one more round.
Yeah. That was Splendor Duel from 2022. All right. And the last game we're going to review is Faraway, a game by Johannes Guppy and Corentin Lebrat. This game is from 2023. Again, another game that I thought was from 2024, but it's from 2023. The first thing I want to talk about Faraway is the lore. The first two pages of the rulebook have lore about Alula, which is the land where you're exploring here in Faraway. I don't really understand it. Like, I think they're trying to make you interested in the game. I think the game shines on its art. You don't need this lore.
Have you invested enough time on the lore?
I mean, besides the rulebook, is there more?
I don't know. Maybe if you Google those terms, you could find some more lore about what are the different terms.
Nowhere does it say, like, this is notes on Alula. It's a continent where balance reigns supreme, wildlife, flora, and even rocks. In this strange land strip. So it's just
I'm getting sleepy.
Yeah, no, it's a completely made up world. So I'm like, what? Like, is there aim to maybe make more games about Alula? Is it like, I don't know. They try to make it like a huge, they talk about this, the seasons, and like, they talk a lot about weird stuff. I don't really understand, because they take two pages of it and then they give you a complimentary scoring sheet instead of using those two pages to explain. So.
And that was Faraway by Guppy and who's the other designer?
No, and I was just like, it's a weird kind of way to introduce the game. Like, I've seen it on bigger games, not on simple card games like this one. So that's the first thing that kind of throws you off. And like, I don't think anybody cares about that. Like, when you're explaining the game, you're like, oh, look at the gold log. No, you say, look at the pineapple, or I need pineapples. You don't say, look at the okiko, which is the animal. No, you say like, hey, I want the devil or the cow or whatever. Like, who cares, you know? But it's a super interesting thing that they decided to do with this. I appreciate it, but I feel it was interesting. It was weird. Anyway, how this game works. It's a simple card game where you're an explorer. You have three cards in your hand and you're building an 8-step journey across a mysterious landscape of Alula. And throughout your eight-step journey means 8 rounds. Each step or each round, you're going to put one card down, which means you're visiting one person. Every single step, you're going to visit another person, which will give you requirements of what you need to collect or what they want for you to visit on your trip. The way you score is that you put all of your 8 cards, and then on the way back, you start looking at the last card first and you start seeing, okay, did I complete the requirements of this person that I visit here? And then they might say like, hey, I want you to visit red cards or red places, the red locations, or I want you to bring back okiko, which is the animals, the cows. But the interesting thing is that on the 8th card, you're only looking at the 8th card. You're only looking at the cards that are revealed. You're looking at the very last card. So you have to plan your strategy forwards, but that you have to think that you're going to be scoring backwards. So it's a really interesting puzzle that you have to solve by visiting different locations. And the cards have symbols. They have the cards. Some cards have requirements. Some cards require you to visit different color cards, or that you visit different places at night or on day. And this all translates to symbols on those cards. And the interesting thing, or the last interesting thing of the puzzle, is that every card has a number, a unique number. Every card is unique. If you play a card that is higher than the previous card on your 8-step journey, so in your second step, or your second card is higher than the first one, or the third card is higher than the second, and so on, you also get an extra bonus card, which is an ancient ruin. I don't remember the exact name in the board game, but it's like an ancient ruin where like these are always visible. So this doesn't matter. These are not steps on the journey. This is like things that you visited, you put it on your notebook or whatever you want to say thematically. So you will always have this requirement. So some cards have the pineapples or the cows or the colors that you need, which can help you fulfill those requirements on maybe those later cards, which will be the first one that they're scoring. It's super simple game. It's really easy to understand, really easy to play. I've played now, I don't know, maybe 6-7 times. I haven't recorded the times that I played. I played with 2 people and I played with 4 players. I think this game does not work with 2 players because the cards that you see are very restricted. Like, you don't get variety on what you want to choose. This game goes up to 6 players. I've never played with 6 players. I think this game would shine more with more players, because then you get that variety on the cards that you can allow you maybe to choose, make it less restricted possible. Because sometimes when you have less people, then you feel very limited. When I played with 2 players, I felt very limited about what I can do and how I can build this puzzle of visiting the right cards, picking the right cards from the center. So everything feels a little bit wrong. I thought there would be a variant. Maybe there's a variant online that I haven't checked about, like, how to give more options for two players or for lower player count. At least not in the rulebook, it's not.
Yeah, I can see it like being a real problem, because if it's like two players, so if the draft or the flip of the cards, it's bad for you, but it's okay for me, it means that it's actually really good for me because I'm playing only against you.
Yeah, and the draft is always the number of players plus one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you see less cards, you get less cards, mm-hmm. you get less options. It's really, I feel there's something broken a bit there. The game is also super easy, same as Splendor Duel. The game is quite easy to play, so it doesn't feel like a lot of investment. We played yesterday, Jonas. What did you think about it?
To me, Far Away feels like scoring the game. And this category of games, because I feel like there's also a couple other games that fall under this category. This category of games is just not so much fun for me. Like, I honestly don't get what others see in these games. You know, I'm not yucking anyone's yum. If you have fun with these types of games, you know, that's great. I don't understand, like, what's the big appeal?
Yeah, I hear you. I think, like, the appeal is, like, just trying to find the puzzle. Like, just trying to put the cards that hey, like, if I do this, then I do. So feeling that satisfaction of things working out.
Mm-hmm.
I think I had several turns where, like, my last card is, like, if I happen to play this card, I maybe get the Ancient Tomb or whatever it's called. Maybe, and then I get the pineapple that I really need to score those cards. If I don't, then I don't have a pineapple. And therefore, so kind of making that work, or like kind of figuring out on the last few turns how you're going to like put everything together, it feels satisfactory when you pull it off. And I think just building that little mini puzzle, which is indeed for scoring purposes, and at the end of the game, the scoring feels quite tedious indeed. It should be an app that just scores. And I think, I don't remember if somebody has talked about this also.
Hmm.
But yeah, definitely. I do hear you. I think that satisfaction of building the puzzle is cool, but with two players at least, when you're super restricted, the satisfaction kind of feels very luck-driven. So it's not really good. It doesn't feel like you're building yourself anything.
Yeah, but here you're building yourself up for scoring, right?
Yeah.
But then, okay, because my game feeling is most of the time like, ooh, I really hope I get that specific card that improves the scoring on this card. And then sometimes like, oh no, I didn't get that card that improves the scoring on this card. But if I compare that to games that do a little bit more engine building, where, you know, things get compotastic, I think those are just inherently more fun. And these kind of games just make me think that, well, why wouldn't I just be playing, you know, a more compotastic light engine builder, such as Splendor.
Yeah, that's true. This is actually a game that I would not recommend people to buy. Like, I think it's nice to play. I think I would play it anytime. I have it because I wanted to buy it. But it's one of those games that I don't need in my collection. I would not recommend people to buy it in their collection. I think, like, if you play it, it's fine. The cards are fantastic. The game looks very nice on the table. It's really cute. But yeah, it's an okay game.
Huh. Is this the first okay game that you are reviewing?
Is it the first okay game that I'm reviewing? I don't know. You have better memory than me.
My memory is that most games are usually fantastic. In this game, only the cards are fantastic.
No, the cards are fantastic. And I think Rebirth was also like...
True.
Because it was like, I think I'm reviewing everything, not only good game. Yeah, this is a game for sure. Don't buy it if you don't need it. If somebody wants to play with you, play it for sure. It's quite fast. But get it from the library, get it from somewhere else, or play it in your board game. But you don't need this game in your collection, I think. That was Far Away from 2023. All right, Jonas, now to the topic of the episode. We're going to discuss The Teach. And first of all, Jonas, tell me, what is The Teach?
What is The Teach?
Yes.
The Teach is the teacher teaching the teachable, which in this case is the board game that is about to get taught.
What do you think about the concept or the term, The Teach?
I like The Teach as a term. I know it feels a little bit of jargony. You know, it's like very hobby-centric, but I think it's like a very handy term.
When should you use the term, The Teach?
For example, when you're discussing teaching board games in a board gaming podcast. So you don't always have to say, what is a good way to teach a board game?
Yeah.
You can just say, what's a good teach?
Should you use The Teach always?
As a term?
Yeah.
Depends. Maybe not always. Maybe sometimes you might come off as a little bit weird, smug.
Yeah, I'll tell you, like, you should not use The Teach with people outside the hobby.
Okay.
I think that's a strong no.
Do you have experience about this?
No, I just feel like it's like one of those things that will make you look like a snob, and it will make, like, it's just like if you're playing board games with your colleagues at work, you're gonna say like, "Hey, I'm gonna explain the rules now." And you're not gonna say, "Sit down, you're about to get the teach," or "Hey guys, I am doing the teach. Please shut up."
Like, or "Hey, don't worry, it's a very easy teach."
Yeah, no, you're just like, "Hey, don't worry, the rules are simple. Let me explain."
You know, you said it with such conviction that I thought that there is going to be like a real life example, but this is just your opinion.
I just feel like this is a type of term that people that are not in the hobby will say like, "Oh, you're in the hobby." So,
so other people refer to board gaming, the hobby, as the hobby.
I think, you know, my
Louis's
friends,
hobby is the hobby.
Yeah, my friends make fun of me when I'm like, "Oh, because Louis is in the hobby." So, for sure, I think this is like a game that is like not needed to be used outside of the friends that are in the hobby.
Yeah.
But I think this is completely valid. I used to hate the term. Now I have come around to be like, "Hey, this is a great term when you talk to people that are nerds like us and we are in the hobby, then for sure you should use the teach." Tell me, Jonas, what is the best way to teach a board game?
The way I tend to teach the games, which I teach the games in the way that I feel like is generally the best way to teach the games, completely personal opinion. But what I like to start with is like, first to go through, what are we even doing here? You know, who are we and what's the end goal? Then what I like to do is usually like point out the things that you will see in front of you. So what kind of board we have here? What are all the different pieces? If you have a personal board, what is that? What are the different things? But, you know, not going too deep into the different, you know, the terms and the mechanics. And I actually like to use the component sometimes as like a safety check, making sure I don't miss anything, you know? And after that, I like to teach the game not according to the rule book, but according to the player reference, if there is a player reference that you can pass along. Because this allows people to kind of follow along what is being taught. But while I teach it, I do keep consulting the rule book, because there's always stuff that's easy to miss, and player references notoriously have lacking information and don't always have that one specific rule that is actually like is really good to know and will come up quite often.
Yeah, for sure. Let me tell you, Jonas, what professional board game teachers say about how you should teach.
Okay, who is a professional board game teacher?
I don't know. I just Googled and I saw like three or four different blog posts. Like, I'm a professional board game teacher at a board game cafe, basically. So they work at a board game cafe and they explain board games.
Okay.
And there was like somewhere in Board Game Geek like post and somewhere like just online blog posts randomly. And I kind of condensed the main recommendations from experts on how you should teach a game. Well, actually, this is more generic, so it's not specific to how you said it, but I was like, this is how you should teach a game. First, you should know your audience, who you're talking to. You should know what's their level of experience. You should know whether they are experienced board games so you can reference other board games, or you have to simplify things quite a lot. That's for sure. That's the first thing. Do you know your audience when you're explaining a board game?
So what I do is I have this form of roughly 500 the most popular games that exist. I pass it along and everyone checks the games that they already know. And then I cross-reference them and see like, okay, what terms can I use here?
Yeah, obviously. That's definitely like what you have to do. Otherwise, you're not in the hobby. Yeah. Know the game rules. It's a second recommendation, obviously. For sure. When you are explaining a game to other people, you should generally know the rules. But the interesting thing about here, and the one thing I wanted to ask you, is like, is it okay, Jonas, sometimes not to know the rules?
I think it's only okay if there's like consent to it. Like a situation where I could see it being like okay is that we're at a convention and we literally have nothing to play, and we see that one game that everyone has always wanted to play, but none of us know the rules. And let's say it's also like notoriously out of print. I think that's a situation where we can all agree that, hey, you know what? Let's just learn it from the rule book now together and then play.
Exactly. That's exactly the same exact example that I was thinking about. Like, when is it okay not to know the rules? This particular example, in every other case, I think you have to do your due diligence. If you're explaining the game, you need to know the rules. You need to at least try to make an effort to make the board game night enjoyable to everyone. What is your responsibility towards making the board game night enjoyable, Jonas? Like, do you think it's the responsibility of the board game teacher to make, at least in general, like an effort to teach the teach in a way that will make the night enjoyable? Are you responsible as the board game teacher to the enjoyment of the table?
I think you kind of are. I mean, someone could make the argument that, you know, the teacher is only responsible for teaching the game. But there is no master of ceremonies at the board game table. So usually the teacher is also kind of like the game master. Just like, you know, generally like the host, even though they're not necessarily hosting that event.
Exactly. And I think this is something that the experts at least didn't touch on, which is like, you should make sure from your experience, at least from what you know of the game, to try to be like, hey, I know that people, if we don't, like, for example, what you did with us with Food Chain Magnate, that you're like, hey, I know if we don't pay attention to these particular strategies, it might be that you will not enjoy the game, that you might actually have a bad experience. And I think that's a responsibility of the board game teacher, if you want your players to enjoy the game, to at least be like, hey, last time I played it, somebody didn't explain this. And I think that's something really important. Or these are the things that you have to focus on. One thing they touch on, the experts, is that explain the strategies to win, but not all of the strategies. Don't go into over-explaining. But I think they didn't specifically touch sometimes into like, hey, how do you make sure that people understand what to focus on in the game?
Yeah, but I have had ones that over-explain teach. For a game that should be taught in 15 minutes, I had a 45-minute teach that involved a lot of pointers from the teacher. And at some point, inside my head, I was just screaming, like, please just let me play the game.
For sure. I think this should be done with care. And I think maybe that's why the experts don't recommend it. But I think when you are a good teacher, you know which ones to say and which ones to be like, hey, just bear these ones in mind, because people tend to forget that specific rule, for example.
Yes.
Another recommendation is to plan the teach a bit. I think that's pretty straightforward. If you're already thinking about this, then you should plan how you're going to explain this. Just for example, you said that you take the rules reference and or the player's reference and then reference that with the rules. Talk about the theme, explain the goal, which is things that you say, like who are we, what we're going to do. And then at the end, let people ask questions. Mm-hmm. Now, however, Jonas, I wanted to ask you, when is the right time to ask questions in a board game teach? How do you behave when somebody's explaining, and how do you like people to behave when you are explaining a game? Do you like people asking a lot of questions?
So I like to encourage communication and questions when doing the teach, or like not when doing the teach, but like when we end up playing, you know, if you have a question about something, like, you know, voice it out. If you are seeing something interesting happening on the board, like, hey, voice it out. That's going to make the experience much more fun for everyone. And because of this, even though I have prepared to teach most of the time and I, you know, kind of like will answer all of your questions during the teach, people will ask those questions of like, hey, what's this? What about that? Hey, what is this card here? What does it mean that this says the provost? So I just kind of like politely either answer very quickly or then say like, hey, I'm going to get to that later, because I want to encourage that communication. I don't want to like shut off communication completely. But but the thing I was like thinking, or like the most fun situation of this is, do you remember in Essen when we were demoing that one particular game that had those two other people joining the table? So we had that four people game.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say the name of the game here in the podcast because I don't want to, like, you know.
You don't want those people that will never meet us again to know that we talk about them.
The people who demo those games at Essen, they probably know how to demo those games if I would wake them up at 4 a.m. in their beds and say like, hey, give me the teach. And they will give you the teach. They will touch all the points that you need to know during the demo. And we were sitting at this demo table learning the game, and there was one person constantly asking, hey, what about this?
Yeah.
Well, what about that? And I was just kind of like laughing about it, thinking to myself, I think they will get to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. Like, shut up, man. Like, let us hear the explanation and then you can ask the question.
The questions that do get to me, you know, even though I want to encourage questions, the questions that get me a little bit annoyed are the questions about those super weird edge cases.
Yeah.
You know, someone asked like, oh, is that money limited? Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, we're not going to run out of the money. We don't need to know. Yeah, but like, should we check the rule book if it's limited? And I'm like, this is going to, it usually turns into a 5-minute conversation about me trying to look through the rule book, someone checking BGG, and then we come to the conclusion that, yeah, it is not limited. And if it runs out, keep it track on paper, but it will never happen.
Yeah, I think it's very few games where it becomes important or it's relevant. And I think if it's relevant, they will say it in the rulebook. Or it will be obvious, like it will be obvious from the mechanics or something, from like, hey, is this something? Yeah, so I agree. What about you, Jonas? Like, how do you normally behave when somebody's teaching you a game? Do you like interrupting, or do you try to interrupt as little as possible until the end?
I feel like I'm being questioned here because you have seen me, of course, how I interact when a game is being taught to me. I guess I make an occasional joke when something is pointed out in the theme, but at least I do try to not ask too many questions, or I try to save my questions to the end. Is that right?
I think so. I'm just saying, what is the right way to behave when somebody's teaching you a game? I want this to be educational for our listeners.
Ah, well, you know, just stay engaged.
Yeah, stay engaged, listen, pay attention. Don't interrupt if you can avoid it, unless it's something that seems that is obviously relevant to what they're saying and they're already skipping to something else.
Hmm.
I think there are a few times when that happens, but you feel like the explanation is already ahead. You understand most of the concepts. You feel like something hasn't been explained, and then it feels like the topic has moved ahead of that topic. I think that's where, like, hey, what is that? And then it's like, you notice that. I think from playing multiple games, sometimes you notice like, hey, maybe they skip this area. And
yeah.
Sometimes I think that's okay to interrupt.
Yes.
And I guess it really depends on who you're playing. I think the more you play with the same people, you know how people explain the games, and you know how and when maybe it's like the questions will come later. So I don't need to interrupt Jonas until at the end I will ask some questions, for example.
Yep. But, you know, even when I teach the games, like, that's a good point. Like, you will miss certain points.
Yeah.
And it is nice when someone asks, when you're moving to a different part of the board, it's like, hey, what was that thing?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot to talk about this.
Yeah,
it is actually the most important top part of the game.
Yeah. And then if I'm teaching the game, I'll be like, hey, yeah, actually, I'm going to talk about that one when I'm connecting it with something else. So don't worry too much about it. So that's for sure. It's good. What do you hate about teaching a game? Like, not to somebody else or not somebody interrupting or whatever, but like, what is like something that annoys you?
It annoys me to read rule books. I don't like reading rule books. If you're going to ask, well, would you prefer a rules video? I don't like watching those either. So it's just like the general learning of how the game works. That's not the fun part.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I love reading rule books. And I actually love like just watching some rules explanation, especially after I have read the book.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else that you hate about teaching board games?
No. Yeah, but I think this is might just be like a little bit in my nature, because at work, I do quite often facilitative type of work.
Mm.
So I feel like when I'm teaching the game, I'm just like, hey, this is just facilitation.
Do you prefer then, I just want to understand because this was interesting. Do you prefer to play a game and then explain a game that you have played rather than reading the rule book from scratch and understanding that game and then explain it?
I can read the rule book 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And teach the game and will struggle to kind of remember everything. But if I read the rulebook once, then play the game, I can easily do the teach afterwards.
Yeah.
Just playing the game, it just like solidifies all the information in your head.
For sure. But I was asking more like, do you prefer that somebody teaches you the game first and you have to be the first person that teaches that game ever? Because you said that you don't like reading rulebooks.
Yeah, I guess I would, you know what? If you are a genie that can grant me any wishes,
yeah,
then I think it would be nice if, for example, Chilla would read all the rule books that I need to read. And then when we go to bed, she would kind of like explain me the games and I can just like listen while I fall into sleep.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, not realistic though.
Yeah, I want to talk about a little bit of my pet peeves or like things that I hate. People over interrupting when it's like, hey, they already told you they're explaining the game and then people keep interrupting. But this, calm down. Like, I know that you're asking questions, but like, we're going to get to that. That for sure. I think when I'm explaining the game, I'm able to control a bit more of the narrative and those people and be like, hey, it's okay. Let me just explain. I'll tell you later. But when somebody else explains the game and I'm listening and somebody is interrupting that person and they're not able to kind of control, it really stresses me sometimes. It's just like, shut up. Like in that example of Essen, it's just like, shut up. And it's just like, well, it frustrates me. I think, I don't know why. Another thing that annoys me a lot, and if Mia is ever going to listen to this, is when people say, let's just play. And like, but there's actually important rules that you're missing. No, it's okay. Let's just play. And like,
so this happens to you in real life. Yeah, I just thought it's like a joke.
No. It happens to me. Most of the time it's like with simple games. I think with more complex games, I think Mia has to most. Like, I'm willing to listen to the rules And like, I'm not willing to listen to all of the rules. And sometimes it's just like, hey, let's just play this game. I kind of got it. And then it's like, hey, maybe our first game is not going to be great. And we have to learn how to kind of adapt to that. And I think it's fantastic because you're like, for example, this Splendor Duel, the first time we play, like, let's just play. Mm-hmm. And like, okay, sure. Like, and you do this and you do that. And then we're just like learning together. So it's like kind of a rule stitch. Like if you were using Dice, for example, mm-hmm. the app to read a rule book. But in some games, it can really get me like, this is then going to be a 2.5-hour experience broken because we don't know the game. And it's going to be like, then why are we playing this game? Let's just then play another game that is simpler. That is too. So sometimes this kind of annoys me. This happens mostly with people that are not in the hobby.
Yes.
I think people that are in the hobby are really understanding like, hey, if I want to play, if I want to have a good experience with my friends, then I need to know the rules, or at least the most important part of the rules. I think those are the two main things that annoy me. And it doesn't happen only with me. It has happened with other people. Like, let's just play. And I'm like, maybe let's choose an easier game then.
So what about the experienced player? So you're teaching a game, but there's also a player who has played it before and has also probably like taught the game and also likes teaching games. And you kind of like, you start teaching a game and then they like interrupt and start kind of like pointing out like, oh, and hey, this thing here and that thing there.
It really depends on how well I plan to teach.
Mm-hmm.
If I plan to teach really well, it really annoys me because I'm like, hey, I got it. Like, yeah. I know this game. I know how to teach it. I know what I'm doing. If I don't know for sure, it's like I actually find that super relaxing and super satisfying because then I'm like, hey, did I forget something? Tell me. Like, so it really depends on my level of experience with the game and my level of knowledge of the rules of the game and maybe my level of confidence on the teach that I'm providing. So if I'm providing a good teach, which I tend to try to achieve if I'm explaining a game, it's a little bit more annoying. Like, hey, I got it. I'm going to explain things. Just if I didn't explain something at the end, then maybe let's clarify. What about that's the other question that I wanted to tell you.
By the way, before you ask that question, I am totally guilty of this.
Yeah.
I think I do it way too often when people are teaching the game. I sometimes jump in like, hey, you know, you actually missed that thing.
Yeah.
And then there's like, yeah, I'm about to get to it.
Yeah. It really depends. If I missed it, I'm like, okay, fair enough. But like, I don't get that bothered by that. It's just sometimes I'm like, I feel like, yeah, I got this and I want to explain it. And many times, some people that do that are actually doing a disservice to the people that are learning the game, in my opinion, because they're confusing.
Yeah.
They're making things more confusing.
Yep.
I wanted to ask you the same question, actually, but in reverse.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when somebody's teaching a game and you know the game and you feel that the person is not doing a good job at explaining the game? How do you feel? What do you do?
That's a tough spot.
Yeah.
I think most of the time, it's still better to rise up to the occasion and just kind of like aid the teacher, not take over the teach, but just keep pointing out those rules mistakes that they kind of like keep making over and over again.
Yeah. I try to be more a friend of the newbies, where like I would like, if they ask a question or if they have a question during the game, or like I try to also aid the teach, but I try to be like, oh yeah, that's something. I try not to interrupt the teacher but somebody has a question, then I try to explain on the side without really being intruding to the person explaining the game. Anyway, last question, Jonas. Should you win a game that you just taught?
You can win the game that you just taught, but I think you should give yourself handicaps.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Okay, so my favorite handicaps that work with most of the games. First one, play faster. You know, once you start playing faster, you will make more mistakes and you can't like min-max every move. So that's like makes the playing feel more, you know, even.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like nothing worse than watching the teacher of the game or the owner of the game beat everyone who's playing the game for the first time and just like taking tons of time thinking on their turn while everyone else is watching.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, this is like an extreme, you know, extreme example. But I just think that like when you start to play faster, you will make less optimal moves and, you know, just like improve the flow of the game. So the experience will be better for the newbies.
For sure.
Second strategy I have, like the second handicap that I feel like works in most of the games is to think out loud. Think out loud your strategy. This lets the other people know how to hurt you, which makes it easier for everyone else to gang up against you because you're kind of like the likeliest winner. So it's nice to get that one versus all mentality when there is like one very experienced player.
Yeah.
Now, the next strategies are something that, you know, they don't work in every game. But I also, what I like to do is like, I try to try an alternative strategy, like a strategy path I have not tried before. And I'm thinking like, okay, that probably doesn't work. But hey, now I get to try it, you know? Yeah. I don't need to win this game.
Yeah.
Or like in some games, or this is much more specific, games like in Root or All Bridges Burning, pick the faction that can kind of like create balance in the game. So making sure that no one is getting that like big lead, because these types of games usually can have that thing where you're playing it for the first time and you don't realize the implications of all of your moves and how to like track if someone is doing really good in the game or not.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think a couple more things is like that you can give more takesies backsies, as we say, like allow opportunities to take back or maybe redo a turn, even if their turn already passes. Like, hey, I really wanted to do that. Then it's like, okay, sure. Like, you can do it. I can't because I taught the game. I have experience and it's like, give or I have one, you have two or something like that. That could be a enjoyable experience, especially in games that are more complex and easier to make mistakes.
Yeah, but also games that have less interaction. Because if you do that in an interaction-heavy game, you are usually end up screwing up someone else's plans. Because if you start doing this in an area control game, it usually means that there's another newbie sitting there and be like, oh, they do a taxi paxis to like build that fortress where I'm just about to attack. Like, come on.
Yeah, for sure. I think it really depends on the game. So for sure, you can be like, no, it's too late. And I think the last thing is like maybe when they're about to do something, you can be like, hey, I don't want to tell you what to do, but like, I think that could be a mistake because this could mean, especially if you're like more than one experienced player on the table, you can be like, because if you do that, then look at what they could do to you. And so like, try to like coach them a bit more, even though it can be maybe annoying sometimes. So you have to have a right balance, but like try to coach them in order to prevent them from making like mistakes that would make them not feel great about.
Yeah. The thing. And especially, I think it's always fair to point out the noob traps.
Yeah.
You know, like, hey, to first-time players, they will always make this mistake and this will make you lose the game. Can I ask you a question about, after you have studied these professional board game teachers?
Yeah, exactly.
So how many games does a professional board game teacher need to know or need to be able to teach?
I don't think anybody mentioned that.
Because a board game, professional board game teacher at a board game cafe cannot just, you know, when someone comes to them and is like, hey, can you teach Root to us? We're about to play it. And they can't go like, oh, I don't know that now. Let me go home, read the rule book, and then
I think they must know at least 500 games.
500, that's a lot.
Yeah.
How many games would you be able to teach without prepping the previous night?
Probably 100.
Huh.
I would say like without prepping the previous night.
Let's just focus on the only heavy games. If you count
I think
games.
500 is like, when I say 500, is like,
yeah,
that includes Jenga and Splendor Duo.
Absolutely. But your personal count.
For heavy games?
Yeah.
I don't think I know more than 20 that I could teach. Okay, without prepping a lot, with just like, hey, let me check that on the rule book because I kind of remember maybe 20, 30.
By no prep, I mean that you take the board game, for example, to the meetup without reading the rule book the previous night. And then someone says like, I want to play that game. And you can be like, all right, I'm going to open the box lid. I'm going to take the components rule book. Let's start playing.
I think at most 30, like heavy board games.
Well, 30. I say heavy, but I guess I mean like strategy games, you know, games that have a rule book that's more than 5 pages.
No, like, then I would go back to my 70.
Wow, I think I would probably have like 10
No
games.
Way. Really?
Yeah.
Because like, for example, I haven't played Spirit Island in, I don't know, maybe 2 years.
Yeah.
I could grab that box and like start explaining it. Yes, I would have to reference the book for sure. But I'm pretty sure I could explain most of it without the rule book.
Yeah, for me, if it's been 2 years since the last play, no, I need to read that rule book.
I would read the rule book because I would like to read the rule book and be prepared a bit. But like, I could also just be like, if somebody went to my home and be like, hey, I want to play that game. I'm like, sure.
But I'm talking about, okay, yeah.
Yeah, but I have over 200 games at home.
Yes. and I'm not asking like whether you are able to somehow teach the game, but more like, are you able to deliver a teach that you feel good about? Like after the game, you'd feel like, hey, I did not need to read that rule book the previous night. I was able to give a good experience.
Yeah, I would say it's 70.
Well, good for you.
But this is more than 5-player game.
Yeah,
more than 5.
Lewis is holding Splendor Duel. Splendor Duel.
This is already count in your definition of heavy game.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. 70 at least.
Okay.
So a board game professional, I would say at least 200 maybe. Maybe 500 was a lot. I was thinking about Jenga and chess and all this stuff. Like, you can be like, yeah, sure, whatever. All right, there you have it. Those are our thoughts and our recommendations how to behave and how to teach a game. I hope you are able to get something out of it. We want to thank you for your time. Our next episode is airing in 2 weeks. In the meantime, you can visit BoardGameOK for more information about the show.
Kuulemme siinä.